Now it's time for one of the most requested items from the last 12 months on BBC 7, Michaela Saunders' interview with Peter Cook, the voice of radio's most dashing detective, Paul Temple. The interview was originally split into short features in our Crime and Thrillers Hour, but now you can hear the great meeting of minds in full. It's Peter Cook and the Paul Temple Affair.
Peter Cook is an actor, a playwright and an artist. Born in 1913, he trained at RADA and acted on stage and screen alongside the likes of James Mason, Gracie Fields, Roger Livesey and Peter Sellers. He wrote comic plays such as Breath of Spring, which was also made into a Terry Thomas film. And he's a dedicated artist, creating intricate and extremely beautiful flower displays out of the tiniest seashells. But he's best known as radio's most debonair detective, Paul Temple. Written by Francis Durbridge, the series ran from 1938 to 1971, with Peter Cook in the title role at the height of its success in the 50s and 60s. Paul Temple was a suave and sophisticated man who lived a glamorous lifestyle in the jet-setting upper echelons of society, a crime writer turned private eye who was frequently sent for by Scotland Yard to help with their most difficult cases.
I'd like to help you, but...
Temple, I don't think you realise just how serious this business is. I saw the Home Secretary this morning. He said, tell Paul Temple...
You tell the Home Secretary that if you finish writing my novel, I'll catch Alex for you.
Oh, really?
Usually accompanied by his devoted and resilient wife, Steve, he went on a series of adventures that invariably involved murders, shootings, fast cars, cocktail parties, nightclubs, and dramatic cliffhangers.
By Timothy! Steve, look!
It's the little Dutch doll.
In June, I went to visit Peter Cook in his Chelsea flat that would have done Paul and Steve proud. Now a sprightly 92 years old and every inch as charming as Paul Temple himself, I began by asking how he got the part in the first place.
I had been in the Paul Temple before I actually took over, because I had been the villain once. So they knew my voice, the Paul Temple people. And Francis Durbridge once took... He said, I want you to come out to lunch with me. So I thought that was rather odd, because although he was the writer, you know, and I was only the actor, I thought so. And I was quite, you know, I didn't play big parts in Paul Temple. And he came and he said, we want you to take over Paul Temple. So I said, well, that'll be absolutely marvellous.
Look, Sir Graham, I admit I'm interested in this case, but I'd like to hear your side of the story.
Very well.
Let me have the facts. Assume I know nothing whatever about the case, Inspector.
Right.
But, he said, now let's get this absolutely straight now. You are a writer of plays. I have two plays on in the West End at that moment. And I am a writer of plays. And you are not to alter one single sentence or word of what I write, although you're a writer. So I said, well, of course I wouldn't. And I only once ever did. And there were lots of things which I'd like to have changed. I hated saying by Timothy.
You hated saying by Timothy?
I hated saying by Timothy because it seems so old-fashioned. And he wrote all the time. I don't know if you ever remember, but he did.
Oh, yes.
Was always saying, by Timothy, there's a man I know or something.
By Timothy, so it is.
By Timothy, so I am.
By Timothy, he's in a hurry.
By Timothy, just look at that suitcase.
And I did say to him once, do you think I could... No, he said. No. It's always been that. You will say that. So I did say that. But I got rather cunning with it. I was going to say, look, there's a man hurrying over it.
So there weren't any other script fights or anything like that?
Well, it was interesting with the scripts because I insisted on having my script before we rehearsed, which they never did, because I like to know exactly what I'm going to do. And people used to ring me up and say, what's the end? Go on, tell me, what is the end?
Well, what's all this about, Temple? Exactly.
I'll tell you what it's all about, Inspector.
But I never saw the end, because the eighth episode, even I wasn't allowed to see it.
Oh, really?
Because they were so afraid I might give it away to somebody, and therefore then people would know what the end was.
But he didn't commit the murder.
No, he didn't, Reynolds.
Then who did?
Don't you know, Mr. Fabian?
Well, don't you?
Look out, Temple.
Stand back. If anyone comes near me, I warn you, I'll shoot.
Did you ever guess what the end was before seeing this?
I guessed once or twice, yes, I did. But because one got used to his writing, you know. We did a spoof one at the end of... I've forgotten which one it was. But Margie and I, we always used to go out for have a coffee break. And Margie and I stayed behind once. And we very quickly wrote a Paul Temple with all the things that were rather odd in it. And the engineer was a great friend of ours, so he did the music. So we had... I played all the everything, and Marjorie played all the rest. And it was great fun, and we killed everybody off. We left their ordinary names on, all the actors who did it. You know, they were not their characters, but their real names. And slowly they were all killed off in 5 minutes. And they were all very amused, of course, because they were all in it. But Francis, unfortunately, came in with his wife, who was a dear, and he did not think it funny.
Oh, dear.
I had said I'd never write anything, but that seemed to us great fun, but...
He didn't see the funny side. Before you, there were other Paul Temples.
Yes, there was a very good chap called Kim Peacock.
Yes.
Who played before me. He played it quite some time, I think. But I have to be a little careful what I say about that, because I took over from him.
And what was it like, stepping into somebody's shoes?
Awful.
Awful?
And he never forgave me. He thought I'd engineered it, which I had no more idea of doing than flying. But he was very, very slow, and we never got through rehearsals because of that. So I think he had to go, but he never forgave me, and I've always felt guilty. But it was nothing to do with me. Mm. And before that, there'd been about three other ones, but they only played it for one episode. But once I played Paul Temple, all my other work died. I could only play detectives. You know, they said people's minds are so extraordinary. All the producers suddenly dropped me and said, "Oh, yes, of course, you play Paul Temple, so you couldn't possibly do anything else."
Always amazed by just how lifelike everything sounded.
Look out!
I don't quite agree with you about the sound being right. I used to complain always because whether we were having a cup of coffee in a cave somewhere...
Are you sure you wouldn't like another cake, Mrs. Temple?
Oh, quite sure, thank you.
We had the same noise as when we were having a beautiful people in our own house to tea. It was the same awful banging of the teacups.
Would you like some more coffee?
Yes, please, darling.
Here you are.
Thanks.
And I could, you know, you could see it wasn't this right. I always used to complain about that.
And did you do all the things that we heard you doing that were really... very James Bondish. Well, I suppose it's the equivalent.
Yes, yes.
Kicking in doors and what have you.
Look, we've got to get this door open.
Was that you, or did you have somebody else doing the stunts?
No, it was always me.
Really? Yes.
Get out, Wyman, quick!
I can't open the ruddy door!
Was there someone in the studio with you doing the sounds of breaking wood, or did you actually...
Yes, no, we had sound effects, which we probably couldn't hear.
Really?
So it was very difficult, certainly not in the early days. When we were, say, in a thunderstorm, we were abandoned on a lake, I remember once. And there was a terrible storm going on with lightning and thunder. They had a light which flashed when the lightning was going on and the thunder, and we heard nothing.
Oh.
So it was very difficult. To when the light was on, then you said you had to go over there.
Can you help me?
We might have been overdoing it, you know, you didn't know, so it was very, very difficult.
Steve!
But it was in the early days, it was extraordinary. We had a very strange studio at Tottenham Court Road. It was really very too small and awful. And I remember well playing a love scene with Marjorie over in a tiny lavatory over the thing that you do it all in. Because the sound acoustics were supposed to be absolutely right with, because we were imprisoned or something or other.
Oh, Paul!
Digby!
His face! Oh, what's happened to him?
I'm afraid he's dead, Steve.
Oh, no.
Come on, dear. Let's go back to our room.
And I thought, I shouldn't think anybody's ever played, not a love scene, because we were supposed to be married, but a congenial scene. And I think that's probably unique for anybody to play that sort of scene, kneeling on the outside of the bed.
Lovely. It was clean, I take it. Am I right in thinking it was all done live or as live?
It was done live only for the beginning ones.
Right.
Then we could. If I made a mistake or anybody made a mistake, we could stop it and do it again. But in the early days, it was quite extraordinary because they were behind the machines and the producer were behind a glass screen. And when they timed it exactly to however 29 minutes, I think, and often we might overrun it. And then you saw the producer behind the screen going, "So you spoke quicker, 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 quicker." Or if we were underdoing it, "Take it calmly, take it calmly." Then we all spoke slowly so we get exactly timing right.
Goodness. So you used to have to meet the end of the programme for whatever was coming next, obviously. And because they were live, you also had to manhandle quite a hefty script.
Yes, yes. If the microphone's there and you've got your script in this hand, it can be heard. And if they heard the pages being turned around, obviously the whole atmosphere goes. Mm-hmm. So one all had to be terribly careful. And the great horror was that one might drop it. And although we knew it fairly well, we'd rehearsed a lot, one could not make it up. Well, anyhow, one had to bend down to pick up one's damn script. It never happened to me, thank goodness, but it has happened.
How would you have covered the sound, the flump?
Well,
of a
somebody
script
else
landing
with any luck would have come in and said, "I wonder what that funny noise is. Well, never mind, don't let's worry, let's get on with it," or something, which I would have done if it had happened to somebody opposite me.
I must admit, once or twice I've heard slight fluffs or things where people have said the wrong, just one word that could change the whole structure of a sentence, and someone's jumped in and saved the day,
The Cordova pendant was an easy way out. It was worth nearly 5,000.
50,000?
50,000, I beg your pardon. I tell you, it was a shock to me.
I used to have blackouts of certain words.
Oh.
And I'd get nervous when I knew that they were coming.
Oh, dear.
And in one, you see, the producer was so good, he saw me worrying with this and said, I had to talk about a battleship called the you see, I can't think. And so I always got nervous about it and got it wrong. So he said, "It doesn't matter, we'll just change it." And I said, "Well, people will know it." He said, "No." So he just changed it into the battleship Jones or whatever it was. So it was a lot of give and take, and he guided us terribly carefully without ever apparently doing so.
You know why I wanted to see you, don't you?
I haven't the slightest idea.
Oh, come, my dear fellow. I should have thought it was obvious.
It probably is, to you.
Then there's the music, of course, which is the signature tune. Was that on every Paul Temple episode?
Every. Always started with that.
And was it just for the ones that you starred in, or was that for the whole range?
No, all the way through, there was always a bit of it.
Gosh.
Yes.
Because it's a very evocative.
It is. Everybody knows the Coronation Express, yes.
And does it bring back anything to you? Does it make your head?
Oh, yes, I get nervous immediately, although I'm not playing Paul Temple any longer. And it's nothing to do with it. I still have a sort of frisson, thinking, "Oh, my God, we're going to start now." And I wonder why I'm frightened. And I remember, because it could go out on the air and something could happen. One might say, drop the thing and say it, and then that would go all over the world and everybody would be terribly shocked.
You always found yourselves, along with Steve, in the most extraordinary situations.
Yes.
This lady and yourself had bombs going off in your faces.
Yes. Steve, don't open the box!
Your car is exploded,
exploded on more than one occasion.
Good Lord, what was that? Oh, great Scott, that was near here. You're covered in plaster, sir.
There's the rivers, lots of water.
Steve!
Being shot at in lay-by.
Oh! What's happening?
Steve! Look at the bullet holes.
Never, ever were you scared, frightened. I think I heard Steve frightened once, and remarked and said, my goodness, she's afraid, thank goodness for that.
Yes.
How did this not ever strike you as slightly strange, or was that just how it was?
No, it didn't really. We were beyond being murdered, we knew that, because we had to get to the end of the series. We had a wonderful houseboy. I don't know if you ever heard him.
Charlie.
Charlie, yes.
Oh, yes.
Charlie was a splendid chap.
There you are, Charlie. Take that suitcase.
Yes, sir.
No, the heavy one.
Oh, I beg pardon, sir. Oh, crikey.
He was, well, I just think, again, it's quite amusing because you assume that the apartment that you were living in couldn't have been massive because it was a London apartment, but you still had Charlie.
Yes.
What does he do?
Yes,
he opens bottles of gin.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Mix the drinks.
And brought the car around.
Yes, exactly.
Ask Charlie to bring the car around. Tell Charlie to get the car. Tell Charlie to get the car, darling.
Why? What's happening?
He was never threatened, I don't think. I don't think he never got into trouble of any sort.
I think he got duffed up. In one episode, by somebody who broke in.
Oh, Charlie! Paul, what's happened?
Darling, he's not lying on the floor for fun. Someone's knocked him out.
Oh.
Here, Charlie. Charlie.
No, help me. Lift his head up. That's it, Charlie.
But again, it made me smile. He gets beaten up. You and Steve and Inspector, whoever.
Yes.
Just sort of, jolly good chap, pat him on the back. He stands up. Right, I'll go and make the tea.
I'm just making myself a nice cup of tea. Would you both like a cup?
And off he goes. And no question
about it at all. Wonderful.
I think the thing I like about it is the fact that so many horrible details of life that none of us likes to face were just ignored.
Ignored, exactly.
Your car blew
up.
So what are we going to do for a new car? Insurance?
Exactly.
None of that.
And why is it such a success without hardly any sex? No dreadful details of the murders or drugs or anything, which is, you hardly ever turn anything on that it hasn't got those.
It is, I find the whole concept of just a totally different era. Fascinating.
Yes, it is. It's so different. It's changed so much.
Paul! Oh, Paul!
What is it?
We can't play that record.
What do you mean we can't play it?
They've smashed the radiogram.
Have you any idea why, then, that children, and we're talking what I would call kids, teenagers...
Yes.
...are fascinated by the same stories, exactly the same stories, totally unchanged, today, when they could be fascinated with so many other things?
Exactly.
Have you any idea why that would be?
I think because it's exciting and understandable. There's nothing too difficult to understand. And they are just jolly good stories.
If Shelley was lying when he said that...
Shelley wasn't lying, darling. Eden checked up with that girlfriend of his, Marion Faber. She says that she was there when Baker telephoned.
Oh, but darling, she may be lying.
Well, darling, they can't all be lying. Look at the windscreen. By Timothy!
What happened? What was it?
I'll give you three guesses.
What do you mean?
It was a bullet.
So what did you enjoy most about playing the part? Was it the actual situations or...?
I just loved it. I loved it. We were really a family by that time. And we all, both Marjorie and myself, had a lot of acting friends. And slowly we got them in.
One by one.
And they came over and over again. And so they played different parts. One day they'd be the housemaid, and the other day they'd be a countess. And it was so interesting. I loved it. It was the happiest time of my life playing Paul Temple.
So I believe, of what I've read, is that the general conception in the public eye was that you and Marjorie Westbury were married in real life.
We had a mass of letters. They said, you must be married to her because there's this atmosphere between you.
Oh, where's my hairbrush, darling?
Under your nose, where it usually is, dear.
Oh, good heavens, are you in bed already?
And I suppose there was, because we got so used to each other. We weren't married. Neither of us was married, actually. But it did come over that we loved each other.
Isn't that wonderful?
Are you going to read?
No. Are you?
No, I'll switch the light out.
She had an amazing experience. A woman wrote to her and said, I've fallen in love with your voice. So Marjorie wrote back and said, I'm so glad, and everything. And the woman said, I'm going to leave you all my possessions. So Marjorie said, don't be absurd. She sounded like a lovely willowy blonde, but she was actually a little bit tubby. And so she wrote back to the woman. She said, I'm not what I sound, and you are not to leave me, because it's quite absurd. You don't know me. I'm not the character I appear in. The woman insisted, so Marjorie said, all right, I'll come down and see you. So she motored down to Cornwall, I think, and met the woman, and the woman said, I haven't changed my mind. I think you're wonderful. You've got the sort of voice which I admire more than anything. And so Marjorie said, you're not to leave me anything. She came back, and about 2 weeks later, the woman committed suicide.
Oh, dear.
And left Marjorie everything.
Goodness me.
Wasn't that extraordinary, the power of voice?
It is. It's amazing, really.
Quite extraordinary.
And the power of radio, the fact that people assume you look like a
Yes, exactly.
Character.
This is why I can't bear having my photograph taken now. People had a picture in their minds of this rather strong chap who...
Chisel-jawed.
Who could deal with everything. And I like them to keep that picture, not to suddenly have a picture of an old, decrepit old man now. You know, I hate it.
It's a strange thing. I must admit, I've always thought that Steve Temple looked a little bit like Grace Kelly.
Yes, exactly, yes.
That's how I'd see her.
How did you imagine me?
Exactly as you are, funnily enough. Just a little less grey, maybe. But,
as I was, let's say.
Your face does match your voice. No surprises at all. I'd be very surprised if you turned out to be a very portly, red-headed gentleman.
Yes, I used to be red-headed, funnily enough.
Really?
I had bright red hair, which I hated.
Oh, Paul. You look wonderful. How lovely to see you again. Darling.
And have you ever been tempted to get into the side of Paul Temple that I think all of us would like to do a little bit, any form of detective work, or is that anything?
I would be absolutely useless. Yes.
I'm sorry, Sir Graham. I'd like to help you, but I've got this novel to finish by the end of the month.
Temple, I don't think you realise just how serious this business is.
I always think if I came across somebody being beaten up, I'd go up and say, look here, I'm Paul Temple. But I don't know whether I would.
Did you find that the whole of the lifestyle rubbed off? Were you ever tempted to go out and buy yourself a flashy car?
No, never at all. We went back by bus as usual.
Oh, really? Well,
we didn't learn a great deal. It was constant, which was wonderful.
Yes.
Because, you know, actors have long times when they're out of work. But we always knew there'd be Paul Temples coming along.
So you never.
But unfortunately, of course, we did end. Eventually, they decided they put it on TV.
Yes.
And Marjorie wasn't the right shape, and I was a bit old. So they got two other people to do it. Mm. And
not quite the same.
And we were delighted. It was a failure, complete failure. The great thing was that people had to use their imagination. When, as you say, we were in a lake or a fire or something, people had their own idea of it. And they could imagine it much better than any scenery could give them.
I think we can break the door down now.
No, stand back, Sergeant.
What were you doing before Paul Temple came along?
I never knew what I wanted to do. There didn't seem anything I could possibly do to earn any money. But my grandmother, who lived in the south of France in Menton, got me a job with the consulate, with the vice consul. And I was supposed to be going into diplomatic service. But I used to act with the amateurs. We had two beautiful 18th century theatres. It's unbelievable. And very good amateurs. They'd all been professionals. And I said to her one day, can I see if I can get to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts? And she said, well, I don't think it's a very good idea, but you can try. So I came back to England, and I got the Leverhulme Scholarship, which was wonderful, 3 years free tuition and a small allowance. And so I was very thrilled. Then I went off and did it the proper way through repertory, where you do a different play every week. It's unbelievable now. Then I was lucky and came into the West End. And there I was also very lucky in the most strange way that all the plays I went into when I was about 20, 21, were failures, which sounds very astonishing, but it meant that my name was in the paper over and over and over again. Anybody who read it began to think, well, you must be very good to have it all. But it was just sheerly that reason. Then I did a lot of films, one with Gracie Fields, which everybody does remember. And she was a dear woman. I'm very fond of her. I acted with some lovely people. Then I had The War, which, of course, was ruined. I had my name in the lights for the first time at Wyndham's Theatre, which was very exciting. There it was up there. I used to go every evening. There it is, with three other bigger stars, of course. And then The War came, and I joined up. So I had 6 years wasted life. And I came back completely different man, of course. I was what was known in those days, a juvenile, not meaning a baby, but a young leading man.
Yes.
And, of course, I wasn't that anymore. So I had slight worries whether I could get back on the stage. I did, but I'd had an accident in the war, and my spine is absolutely crooked. And I knew the time was coming when I wouldn't be able to act anymore. Mm. But fortunately, I'd written a play, and it was a great success. So I thought, oh, well, I better stop now doing what I can't really do properly. And so I became a playwright.
So since the late 60s, when the series came to an end, what have you been up to?
I moved up to Norfolk, and I'd been doing as a hobby shell work. It sounds awful, but it has a dreadful name. But I have, and I'll show you these because it's rather interesting.
Oh, my goodness.
And they are, you know, I'm now considered rather, I show in Bond Street, and it's all rather grand.
My goodness, that is beautiful stuff.
They're pretty unique. And people come to my gallery. I have a big gallery up there. And they come not to see the shells. I know immediately they come in, they wander around, and then they say, don't I recognize that voice? And I know perfectly well that's why they've come, to see whether they, usually fairly elderly people, whether how they've stood up against me.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I hope I haven't bored you, Siv.
Absolutely not.
Good.
It's been a complete pleasure. Thank you very much for having us.
Peter Cook and the Paul Temple Affair was presented by Michaela Saunders and produced by Ben Motley.